NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. WILL programs are made possible with support from Lincoln Square in Urbana, a lifestyle center which includes a food court with two independently owned coffee shops and cafes, including Piatto's and Uncommon Grounds.
Long before there was Sex in the City, there was Sex in the Single Girl. Written by Helen Gurley Brown, it was published in 1962 and became an international bestseller. Good afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Today, we'll look at Brown and her place within the women's movement of the second half of the 20th century. If you were asked to name feminists of the second wave, I suspect the name Helen Gurley Brown would not be among those you'd list, but women's studies scholar Jennifer Scanlon is out to change that with the very first biography of Brown, Bad Girls Go Everywhere, The Life of Helen Gurley Brown. Jennifer Scanlon, joins us today to talk about the longtime editor of Cosmopolitan, the most widely read women's magazine in the world. Brown served as the editor of Cosmopolitan for 32 years. Our guest, Jennifer Scanlon, is professor of gender and women's studies at Bowdoin College. In addition to women's history, her interests include consumer culture and popular culture. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. I invite your questions and comments. What would you like to know about Helen Gurley Brown? How do you think her iconic Cosmo Girl has affected our culture? I look forward to your telephone calls. Here are the numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Jennifer Scanlon's book, Bad Girls Go Everywhere, The Life of Helen Gurley Brown, is published by the Oxford University Press. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Jennifer Scanlon, thanks for spending some time with us this afternoon.
Thank you, Celeste.
When and how did your examination of Helen Gurley Brown as feminist begin?
Well, it began when I took a road trip to Smith College to look at her papers. Smith College has about 50 boxes of Helen Gurley Brown's papers, and once I got there and started looking at them, I found her a particularly intriguing character, and as I spent more and more time with the papers, I began to formulate my own understanding of her and then my argument about her.
Did you have her cooperation for the book?
Well, I did. It's not an authorized biography, so she didn't read any of it until it was in press. But she did. She had several people who had written to her and asked to write a biography of her, and she always turned them down. And I think what made a difference with me was that I'm an academic, and she wasn't really interested in someone in journalism, or at least, you know, in the entertainment industry, writing about her. And so there was some back and forth between us, and then she agreed. And once she agreed, she gave me absolute full rein and allowed me to quote from all of her published and unpublished work.
Mm-hmm. And what does she think of your book, Bad Girls Go Everywhere?
Well, she's quite pleased. I think she feels she's very kind of open and honest about herself. She's given innumerable interviews, and she doesn't mind having her quirks put down on paper. But I think she's also pleased to be in the limelight again, to get this kind of recognition at this point in her life, since she's 87 years old, and to have someone make a case for her as an important American figure for the second half of the 20th century and not just as, you know, the editor of a magazine.
Yeah. What is she doing now at 87?
Well, she's still working. She has an office in the Hearst Building in Manhattan, and her official title is editor-in-chief of Cosmopolitan International. And what that means is she really serves now as a kind of a consultant to the 60 or so international editions of the magazine. So although, you know, she doesn't read Croatian or Chinese, she actually does look at the individual issues, and she makes comments about mostly about their aesthetics, about the appeal and how they look visually and placement of materials and that sort of thing.
How is the Croatian edition of Cosmopolitan and the Chinese edition of Cosmopolitan different from the magazine we see on the newsstands here?
Well, that's, I think, one of the things that's so remarkable about Helen Gurley Brown and about Cosmopolitan as a brand. You know, I think of Cosmopolitan as a really significant global brand. And in fact, there are differences among the editions, and the individual editors in the different countries certainly have a lot of power to make decisions about what they include. But there's certainly some give and take from New York, and there's basically, even with change in editorship after Brown left the helm of Cosmo, there's still a determination, whether conscious or unconscious or out of fear or whatever, to kind of maintain the formula that she put into place in 1965, amazingly enough.
Yeah. When she came to the helm of Cosmopolitan, the magazine was 80 years old and was in danger of being shut down. What vision did she have for turning it around?
Well, you know, her own mother considered Cosmopolitan a venerable old magazine, you know. And what the people at Cosmopolitan were realizing in 1965 was that they had to shake things up a little bit in order to stay afloat. And one of the ways they thought they would do that was by having more features, by attracting women more as a target audience, and particularly professional women, or at least working women. And so they were sort of favorably disposed to the idea of making Cosmopolitan into even more of a women's magazine. But they definitely took a chance on Helen Gurley Brown. And for a number of years, there was kind of internal dissension about the degree to which she was an appropriate editor for the magazine. But in the end, you know, her incredible financial acumen played out successfully for the higher-ups at Hearst.
Mm. Who did she set out to attract to the magazine, and how did she go about building that audience?
Well, she had realized that she had a significant audience after she published Sex and the Single Girl in 1962. And the way she made her way to a magazine, actually, was that she was receiving so much fan mail after the publication of Sex and the Single Girl, and she was trying to respond individually to each of her correspondents, that her husband actually suggested to her, you know, we need to find a better way for you to communicate with all of these people. This one-on-one business is just not working. And so she had a syndicated newspaper column. She thought that was one way of reaching people en masse. And eventually they hit on the idea of a magazine. So when she took over Cosmo, in fact, when she wrote the proposal for a women's magazine, they shopped it around to a variety of places and then eventually ended up at Cosmo at the right time. But she, in her proposal, she basically targeted the same audience she had targeted for Sex and the Single Girl, which she defined as women much like herself who were young or maybe even not so young, who desired financial independence, who liked to acknowledge themselves as sexual human beings, who liked to have men in their lives, and who liked some degree of beauty and fashion. And so that's the core group she went after, and she never looked back.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit more about Sex and the Single Girl. What was the book like? How were the chapters divided? And she wrote the book when she was no longer single.
That's right. She wrote the book after she had married David Brown, but not too long after. And she had been writing, what I found in her papers is that she had been writing sort of short stories and journal entries all during the years when she was single. And that material isn't directly in Sex and the Single Girl, but it's very much like what made its way into Sex and the Single Girl. So Sex and the Single Girl was a kind of a guidebook, a template for women on how to live on their own. And so there are lots of chapters, the small sort of short chapters about money, about the apartment, about cooking, about the wardrobe, about men and where to meet them. And it formed a kind of a guide for women who found the prevailing wisdom of the day inadequate for their lives. And that was basically sort of the post-war mandate for early marriage, for lots of children. You know, we throw around the baby boomer term now a lot, but these were, you know, this was the years of the baby boom, and she didn't really want any part of that lifestyle, and it turned out that there were lots and, you know, many women out there who felt the same way she did. And so they responded to this book, which told them it was okay to stay single, it was okay to have your own apartment, it was okay to have sexual relationships with men outside of marriage.
Hmm. Was she, could we say she was a pioneer in the genre of the self-help guide?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, Sex and the Single Girl is definitely a self-help book. And it, in fact, a pioneer in a certain kind of self-help, because there were other self-help books that were available at the time. Like if you think about Norman Vincent Peale's The Power of Positive Thinking, there were a number of books like that. But most of them actually provided advice that was in keeping with the general themes of the day. And what was interesting about Brown's book is that it ran counter to so many of the prevailing themes of the day, particularly about how women should live their lives. Mm. So it provided a kind of a self-help book that helped women resist.
Mm. Why have both feminists and conservatives of the latter half of the 20th century been so uncomfortable with Brown?
Mm-hmm. Well, conservatives were uncomfortable with Brown from the start because she was so direct. She was incredibly forthright about sex. And, you know, this was an era, as I said, in which women were encouraged to marry early. They were not encouraged to know much about their own bodies or their sexuality. In particular, the notion of sexual desire on the part of women was really problematic for a lot of conservatives. And so Brown really troubled people with her notion that women had as much sexual desire as men and had the right to act on it the same way men did. And if you think about, say, Playboy magazine reaching publication in 1953, that was even before Sex and the Single Girl. And so what Helen Gurley Brown was saying was that kind of sexual hedonism that Hugh Hefner talked about actually applied to women as well as to men. And so for conservatives, she was really a problematic character who had the potential to sort of, you know, push women off the track that led to happy families and all of that. And so it wasn't just the post-war period, but it was sort of Cold War ideology that she was up against, and she troubled people with her approach. In terms of feminists, there were a number of things that you might say more radical feminists didn't like about Brown. One was her absolute embrace of capitalism. She was very entrepreneurial. She loved earning money. She had no interest in sort of trying to overthrow any kind of system that she saw as the only way for young single women to be able to provide for themselves. So she was an inveterate capitalist. That was one of the issues they had with her. Another was her embrace, really, of beauty culture and of fashion and of mini skirts and, you know, cosmetics and shaved legs and all of these things. There was this notion during the second wave of feminism that, you know, women would benefit by greater measure of androgyny, of androgynous behavior, that it was in part that women dressed and wore high heels and acted the way they did that kept them down. And so there was a effort afoot to sort of challenge that. And Helen Gurley Brown wanted no part of that. She was one of the sort of early practitioners, I say, of what now people think of as the third wave, in that she said, no, you know, wear high heels, wear lipstick, and pursue that job as CEO or airplane pilot or whatever it is that you want to do, that those things are not incompatible.
Yeah. How might she have been seen by the women, the fictional characters of Sex and the City?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I did meet with her a few times and ask her questions about things that I needed clarification on or that I was curious about. And one of those was about Sex and the City, because to me it just seemed so clear that Sex and the City followed on Sex and the Single Girl. Now, she said she had never seen it on television and she didn't really know much about it, but that people had told her that it was a lot like Sex and the Single Girl. I think that if people had known more about Sex and the Single Girl when Sex and the City came out, that discussion certainly would have taken place, because there are a lot of similarities. I mean, just in terms of what it means to be single in an urban environment, to act on sexual desire, to deal with the fact that men still make more money than women, and that men still have a greater degree of kind of social and economic capital. I think all of those things are present in both Sex and the Single Girl and Sex and the City.
Yeah. Sex and the Single Girl, in 3 weeks it sold more than 2 million copies. So there was an eager audience for this kind of book.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think people were chafing with the kind of strictures, not just, you know, men, obviously. I mean, it was widely known, as Helen Gurley Brown wrote, that, you know, with all of these mandates about monogamy and about early marriage and all of that, that the people, by and large, who were practicing monogamy were women, and that men were still behaving in ways that didn't quite fit with the mandates. And so what she did was she really exposed that women had discontents too. And that's, I mean, one of my arguments is that a lot of people have stated that the sort of second wave of the feminist movement started in 1963 with the publication of Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique. And I'm arguing that, you know, a year earlier, actually, Helen Gurley Brown published Sex and the Single Girl, and she had a tremendous impact on young women's lives. And she, I think, you know, impelled a lot of kind of social and cultural changes.
Hmm. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Jennifer Scanlon. She is the author of the first biography of Helen Gurley Brown, the title Bad Girls Go Everywhere, The Life of Helen Gurley Brown. Jennifer Scanlon is professor of gender and women's studies at Bowdoin College. In addition to women's history, her interests include consumer culture and popular culture. This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333 3333-WILL. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Her story is one really of rags to riches. She was born in a little town in Arkansas in 1922. Tell us about her parents, Cleo and Ira.
Okay, her parents were both school teachers, and then her father insisted that her mother stop working in order to raise a family, although she would have preferred to continue working as a teacher. And her father went to law school and then assumed a position in the state legislature. And they moved then to Little Rock, which at the time was sort of a really growing and exciting, vibrant, small city. And what happened there was that during the midst of the Great Depression, when Helen was 10, her father was killed in an elevator accident in the state building. And so their world changed kind of overnight. They weren't wealthy during the Depression, but her father did have a steady income. And they went from that to her mother being the sole parent for these two girls, Helen and her sister Mary. And it was a really challenging time after a number of years of trying to make it in Little Rock, taking in sewing and doing a variety of very small and not particularly well-paying jobs. Cleo decided to move to California and try to make it out there. And they moved out there, and not too much after they moved to California, Mary, Helen's sister, contracted polio. And at that point, I think Helen really emerged as sort of the central figure in the family. She became the significant breadwinner. She became the significant voice in the family, kind of a decision maker for everybody. And she played that role for a number of years until Cleo and Mary eventually moved back to Arkansas, and Helen at that point stayed on in Los Angeles.
Yeah. As you mentioned, Cleo was a teacher who, once she became a mother, had to leave her job at the insistence of her husband. And this, you say, is just one example of how Cleo Gurley's life was often made by resignation. And then after a time when they're in Los Angeles, Cleo decides that she and Mary will go back to Arkansas so that Helen can have a life.
That's right. She really did have such a significant degree of responsibility for her mother and her sister. And her mother felt that she had always made sacrifices for other people. As for her family, when she was a child, she went to college for one semester and then she had to leave to raise her younger brothers and sisters. She felt that she had sacrificed when she gave up her profession because her husband asked her to. And she really didn't want Helen to do the same. She wanted Helen to have a greater degree of freedom. And so when it became apparent that Helen was making all of her choices basically to support her family, Cleo decided it was time to move back. Mm-hmm. She also worried a little bit, frankly, that Helen wouldn't get married if she still had Cleo and Mary to take care of. And so she had some traditional notions as well and wanted to free Helen up to be able to marry.
Mm-hmm. How did Helen Gurley support herself?
She worked as a secretary. You know, like many women of her generation, she graduated from high school and then went on to business school. And, you know, the way business schools worked then, you would go to school for part of the day and you would work as a typist or a secretary for part of the day. And she graduated from business school and worked as a secretary. She had 17 different secretarial jobs before she became an advertising copywriter. And so she supported herself as a secretary.
Mm. And she was quite frugal. on a secretary's salary, she bought a Mercedes-Benz.
That's right. She was quite frugal, and one of, I think, the most amusing or fun, instructive parts of her papers for me were these short stories that I mentioned earlier that she would write on her free time during her single years about what it was like to be single. And, you know, she would offer women advice about how to save money. And one of the major ways that women would save money in her generation was by having men pay for things for them when they went out to dinner, they went out on a date. And she was very clear in Sex and the Single Girl and then afterwards that women should never pay, that going Dutch was never an option, and that women should have men pay. They were the ones who earned the money, and women had to be frugal and count their pennies in order to be able to take care of themselves. In her case, she felt that she might attract just the right kind of man she was looking for if she had a Mercedes, and she eventually paid cash for one by scrimping and saving those pennies and allowing men to buy her dinners out and vacations and all sorts of things.
And occasionally nickel and diming an employer.
That's right. Yep. She she offered advice about that, too. Yeah.
Yeah. She didn't marry until she was in her 30s. How and why had she remained single for so long? Because this is one of those interesting contradictions about her. Do you know what I'm saying? She loved playing the field, but she wanted to settle down and get married.
Right. She loved playing the field, and she wanted eventually to settle down and get married, but she wanted to make sure she settled down and got married to the right person. And so over the years, she had, as she put it later, there were men who wanted to marry her, and she didn't want to marry them, and there were men she wanted to marry who didn't want to marry her. And along the way, there were just innumerable men, married and single, whom she dated. She did eventually want to marry, but as I say, she felt she had done a lot of caretaking in her own family, and she wanted to make sure she married a man who was independent and self-sufficient, and she wouldn't be taking care of him. And so she set her sights pretty high, even though she dated widely, and eventually she met David Brown, who fit all of the particulars of her desires for a man.
Yeah. Now, when she met David Brown, he had been recently divorced. Who was he?
He was a producer in Hollywood. He had a quite successful career by this point. He had gone to Stanford as an undergraduate and to the Columbia School of Journalism. So unlike Helen, he did not come from poor and then any kind of working class origins. He came from a moneyed family in New York, and he had quite a successful career. He had just been divorced from his second wife when he met Helen for the first time, and as impressed as he was by the fact that she owned her own Mercedes-Benz that she had paid cash for, he was still not in any hurry to get married for a third time, and in fact wondered if he would marry again. But she sort of decided he was the man for her, and they went back and forth for quite some time, and eventually they did marry, and they're still married ever since.
Yeah. She gave him an ultimatum, ultimately.
She did. Eventually, she gave him an ultimatum, and that was something that she recommended other women do. She felt that eventually, you know, if this was what you wanted, men just didn't get it. Men were raised differently. She felt men and women were equal in many, many ways. But in terms of having that kind of power in a relationship, she saw things weighed in men's favor. And she advocated that women not just sit around and wait, and that eventually you might have to give a man an ultimatum. And so she did give David an ultimatum. He didn't bite at first, and so she thought they were broken up, but a few days of kind of back and forth conversations, and eventually things settled down, and and they decided to marry.
Why has their marriage been so successful, has lasted so long?
Well, one of the things I think is really interesting about their marriage is that for both of them, it was the first time that they were involved with someone whom they felt was really sort of stable and as interested in the success of the other person as they were in their own success. And so Helen and David, they had to figure this out in the late 1950s and then for the next decades. They had to figure out what it meant to be a two-career couple, what it meant to have a spouse who was very accomplished and very dedicated to work. But I think one of the things that's true of the two of them is that they were equally dedicated to their work. They're both very passionate about work, but they're also equally dedicated to each other. And they never had the kind of either Hollywood or Manhattan life that they could have had. They're very much homebodies, dedicated to each other. And so besides work, the other person was really the most important thing to them.
Mm. So a peer marriage, but a very conventional one.
Conventional in many ways.
Yeah.
Helen really took care of David. And I argue in the book that for someone of her generation, the messages, it was such a kind of a murky waters that they entered into. You know, on the one hand, they had this very progressive marriage because she never gave up her job after they got married. And, arguably she became, more well-known than he did. And there were ways in which his masculinity sort of had to withstand someone like the public Helen Gurley Brown. I argue that in order to sort of compensate for that, she made sure that she took care of him at home, and so she prided herself on cooking meals for him and cleaning up after him. She felt there was a little bit of a cost for a woman to have the degree of independence that she had.
Mm.
And these were sort of the tricky questions that they tried to figure out together.
Yeah, it's interesting. One of the details that you have in this book, Bad Girls Go Everywhere, is that David Brown recalls in his memoir that in all respects, save carnal desire, Helen is the reincarnation of his mom.
Right. Yeah. So she did. She took care of him at home. Although I would argue that, she also put in long days at work, and she often worked on the weekend, much to his chagrin. And she made it clear that work was, right up there for her in importance.
No children?
Her relationship. They never had children together. David had a son from his first marriage, and so when Helen and David first married, the son was Bruce was living with them in Los Angeles, but he soon left the house and went off to college. But he actually was a drug addict, and eventually he died, and that was a very, very difficult part of their lives. But they determined that they were not going to have children. I think that for Helen, one of the things I mentioned in the book is that she was in her 30s before she met a woman who had a secretary rather than who worked as a secretary. And to make it in the world that she hoped to make it in, and then first that was the advertising world, and then second in the publishing world, she really did believe that a woman could not have children and have a professional career. She just didn't see that as available to her. And in fact, that's one of the things I would argue that she still marvels at. When I've met with her, she always brings that up. You really have children, and you do this work that you do. She still finds that somewhat remarkable.
Mm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking this afternoon about Helen Gurley Brown. Our guest is the author of a biography of Brown, Bad Girls Go Everywhere, The Life of Helen Gurley Brown. Our guest is Jennifer Scanlon. She's professor of gender and women's studies at Bowdoin College. She's interested in women's history, consumer culture, and popular culture. All these things come together in this book, Bad Girls Go Everywhere. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. At the helm of Cosmopolitan magazine, she really turned that magazine around, and it is today the best-selling women's magazine in the world. I think that I would be safe to say that Cosmopolitan eventually or ultimately changed women's magazines across the board. Is that fair?
Yes, it is fair. And this is one of the ways in which I think Helen Gurley Brown has been remarkably generous, in that certainly what happened with women's magazines following her enormous success at Cosmo was that they determined that they needed to address sex and sexuality. And so they did. And it wasn't just magazines. I mean, it was magazines like 17 magazines for young women. And it was also magazines like the Women's Home Companion. I mean, even the sort of the very staid women's home magazines began to address women as more full human beings with a variety of desires, including economic desires and sexual desires and desires for a variety of kinds of independence. And I think that Cosmo really had a very significant impact on the world of women's magazines. And the reason I say that Brown was generous is that she never minded that. She never felt that Cosmo, you know, always had to be in competition with every other magazine. There were many magazines that were introduced after her enormous success with Cosmo that sort of tried to reach all these individual parts of women. So, say, magazines about women's health, about women's beauty, about fitness, a variety of things about money. And she always maintained that that was great. You know, I said before that she was sort of the consummate capitalist. She loved the idea of many magazines available to women. But she felt that Cosmo always maintained its niche by meeting all of those needs, by addressing the whole woman and not just a part of the woman. But there's no question that Cosmopolitan has had an impact. And some people would say negatively so, in terms of greater discussion of female sexuality and, I would argue, female independence.
In the book, there are reproductions of a couple of covers of Cosmo. The first, 1965, that was Helen Gurley Brown's first, and her last, 1997 issue of Cosmopolitan, 32 years apart, and you note, they're hardly distinguishable by their content.
It's remarkable. It's just remarkable. And you know, the whole people associate covers of Cosmo with cleavage, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that she really took a beating about by conservatives and by feminists alike, who found that a problematic representation of women. And her answer was, look, I am a realist, and the truth is that it's not just men who enjoy looking at pictures of beautiful women. Women also enjoy looking at pictures of beautiful women. And it's not true that women who look at Cosmo are going to feel inferior because they don't look like the woman on the cover. She said only 5 women in the world look like the woman on the cover. And so the rest of us look at it because we think she's beautiful and nice to look at. And let's see, the market will decide. If women agree with me, they'll buy the magazine. And, you know, for all of these decades, it has changed very, very little.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. Well, speaking of beauty and fitness, back in high school, back in Arkansas, Helen Gurley called herself Mouseburger.
That's right.
What did she mean? How did she see herself? How did she get past that?
Well, she called herself a Mouseburger, and she used that term then over the years to describe a woman who was, of average intelligence, not wealthy, who couldn't rely on either beauty or brains or wealth to get her through, who had to really work to make it. And that was how she always saw herself. And in fact, it provided her with this drive to make it. And she always maintained that every Mouseburger can make it, that was one of the great things about this system, was that there were opportunities for work, that women could be financially independent if they worked hard at it, and they didn't have to be beautiful. That didn't mean that they didn't enjoy looking their best. And so that was how, there were lots of critiques of her, favoring beauty culture and all of that. And she said, no, women don't buy this particular lipstick because it pleases men. They buy it because they like to look nice and they like to feel good. And it doesn't turn them into a raving beauty. They may still be a Mouseburger, but they might be a Mouseburger who then has a little more courage to go out there and take on the world.
Yeah, it's important in the confidence department.
That's right.
Yeah. We haven't really talked about her views politically. She has supported abortion rights. She has supported the rights of gays and lesbians. Before we close, we better talk about those issues.
Yes. She marched in abortion rights marches and in demonstrations for the Equal Rights Amendment. She, from the very beginning of her publishing work in Sex and the Single Girl, and then even in her proposal for Cosmopolitan, she had lesbian stories, lesbian characters. She felt that women's sexuality was expansive, that it couldn't be limited to heterosexuality. She was an absolute believer that women had to have the right to control their own bodies and their reproduction. She saw all of that as fundamental to being female. Some of that, of course, became subsumed in Cosmopolitan because she was working in this capitalist marketplace and she learned what sold, and basically heterosexual sex sold, and politics didn't particularly sell in Cosmopolitan. But occasionally she would make sure those issues were represented in the magazine, and she would go so far as to call up other editors and try to get them, other editors of even magazines like the Ladies' Home Journal, and to try to get them to cover political issues as well, because she felt these were fundamental to women's advancement.
With some years now behind us, have the women of the second wave, have some of that generation now, with the comfort of the passage of time, have they remarked on Helen Gurley Brown and how they see her today as opposed to, say, how Gloria Steinem saw her when Steinem interviewed Brown?
Right. I mean, I would say that there are people who are, willing to revisit this question. I think Gloria Steinem is among them, though. And one of the, I found a fascinating letter in, written actually in 1974, so not even recently, to Gloria Steinem from Helen Gurley Brown in the papers and in Helen's papers. And she says, Gloria, you were such a dear to call us and let us know that all of you people in this movement aren't against us. I knew that. We're working on similar things. We're going about it differently. And I think that there were women at the time who felt that way. I argue in the book that I also think at the time there were, sort of other more radical feminists who were closet readers of Cosmopolitan, who actually enjoyed some of what she had to offer mixed in with their more serious political engagements, right?
Yeah.
So at this point, I think that it's mixed. There are lots of women, lots of feminists of that era who are saying, wow, this is terrific. Finally, Helen Gurley Brown is getting her due. And yeah, we always knew that her story was more complicated. But and there are others who just think it's a ridiculous notion to consider Helen Gurley Brown. So I'd say it's mixed, but I think there are a lot more people who are willing now to entertain her as a feminist.
Yeah. Well, among the photographs, the pictures that you have included in this book is the cover of a New York Times magazine from 1974, August, Two Faces of the Same Eve, Ms. versus Cosmo. And it's the same model. And they're both hotties, right?
Right. But one, you know, looks a bit, one has a turtleneck on, right?
Yeah.
You know, and, so there was this idea that, you know, that readers of Ms. had to be very serious about their politics and couldn't entertain things like the frivolities of fashion, and that was something that, you know, was left over for the readers of Cosmo. And I'm arguing that, you know, it wasn't that simple. And and in particular, I would say for much of Brown's followers who were working class women, It was way more complicated. A working-class woman couldn't just stop wearing dresses to work and makeup and all of that if she worked as a receptionist, you know, even if she wanted to. And I just think that there are some class issues in people's reluctance to see Helen Gurley Brown as a feminist leader, because she wasn't targeting, although she had many readers who were well-educated, she really was targeting less educated, what she called her working girls, and they were less ready to embrace a kind of a more radical, more erudite feminism of the day.
There, we have to leave it. We're out of time. Jennifer, thank you very much for talking with me this afternoon.
Thank you, Celeste.
Jennifer Scanlon is the author of Bad Girls Go Everywhere, The Life of Helen Gurley Brown. The book is published by the Oxford University Press. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock, standing by now with settlements from Kansas City and Chicago, Todd Gleason.
Thanks, Celeste. Taking a look at those numbers as they settled in Chicago in on this rather Tuesday afternoon, which was expiration date for all of the July contracts. So it's kind of interesting to take a look at those in more detail. And we'll do that during the closing mark report this afternoon when we talk with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities in Newmarket, Indiana. But pay attention to the highs and the lows here on some of these contracts, especially in the corn. It was a pretty hefty high for the day, but the low and the close were much closer to the bottom end of that range. Let's start, though, in the wheat pit. July futures down 14 cents today there. For the soft red from Chicago, a 516 top, bottom at 505 and a quarter. Settlement price at 501 and three quarters, down 14. September, a 544 and a half, the high, the low at 525 and a half, and it settled at $5.30, 12 and three quarters lower. December futures, 570 and a half, the high, the low at 552. Settlement price at 556 and a half, down 12 and a half cents. And the March contract, 587 and a half, the high, the low at 570 and three quarters. Settlement price at 574 and three quarters, down 12 and a quarter. July hard red winter wheat in Kansas City, 13 and a quarter lower at $5.50 and a half cents. From the corn pit in Chicago, nearby July contract, that's the lead option, or was through this afternoon. Tomorrow, the September, will be lead option. July contract expired today at noon, down 9 cents with a top of $3.83. And a low at $3.48, settlement price at $3.50, down 9 cents. That's the brand new mark for the lead option to try to get to. And it had a high price today only of $3.39. So even on the high, it was 11 cents short of the settlement price for the July contract. The low at $3.32.5, a settlement price, a gain there in the September futures of 6¾ cents in the corn pit to settle at $3.38.5. December $3.46, the high, the low at $3.39.5, settled $3.45.5, up 6 in the March futures, $3.59¼ the high. The low at 352.5, settlement price at 358 and three quarters, up 6¼. And the May contract in the corn, 368 and a quarter, the high, the low at 62. Settlement price at $3.68 and a quarter, up 6 3/4. July futures settled 377 and a quarter, up 7 1/4 on the afternoon. July oat futures off the board at 209 1/2, down a penny and a half. September now the lead, a 218 and a quarter settlement price there for September oat futures, down 0.75 cents. From the soy complex, July futures in the bean pit were lower on the day. The rest of the pit, like the corn, was higher. And July soybeans, $10.87 3/4, the high, the low at 10.58 1/4, went off the board at $10.74. The expiration, down 17 1/2 cents in July soybeans. August contract, a gain today of 16 cents, 10.37 the high, the low at 10.05 1/2. Settlement price at 10.34 1/2, up 16 on the afternoon. September futures, 8 cents higher, 9.65 3/4 the high, the low at 48 1/2. A settlement price at 9.63 1/2, up 8 in November beans, 9.23 the high, the low at 9.06 3/4. Settlement price at 9.18, 6 1/2 cents higher. January futures, 9.30, the high, the low at 15 1/2. Settlement price for the January beans at $9.26, up 6 1/2 in November of 2010. A settlement price 13 1/2 cents higher at $8.87. July soybean meal, $3.59 the high, the low at $344, settled $344.50, down $14.80 off the board. August, the new lead option, up $1.70 as of tomorrow to be the new lead option anyway. $3.34 was the settlement price. July soybean oil, $33.70 the high, the low at $33.58. Settlement price at $33.65, up $0.38. And the August soybean oil futures, $33.77. Finish the day 37 cents higher. I'll return at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time, just about 9 minutes away now, when we'll talk with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities out of Newmarket, Indiana. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Mike Morris in McHenry at 815-344-7213. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
We turn our attention now to the livestock contracts and how they fare today in Chicago. August live cattle, the high 85.15, the low 84.60, the settlement 85.05, up 27 1/2. October, 90.27 1/2, the high 89.75, the low 90.12 1/2, the settlement down 12 1/2. December, 90.10, the high 89.65, the high 90.05, the settlement, that down 17 1/2. February, 89.62 1/2, the high, the low 89.20, the settlement 89.37 1/2, down 30. August feeder cattle, 103.80, the high 103.05, the low 103.12 1/2, the settlement down 67 1/2. September, 104 even, the high 103.30, the low 103.35, the settlement down 87 1/2. October, 104.05, the high 103.40, the low 103.55, the settlement down 75. November, 104 even, the high, the low 103.55, the settlement 103.55, down 70. July lean hogs, 59.10, the high 58.42 1/2, the low, the settlement 58.70, down 80. August, 64.15, the high 63.27 1/2, the low 63.60, the settlement, that up 60. October, 59.50, the high 58.60, the low 58.95, the settlement up 15. December, 57.82 1/2, the high, the low 57.20, the settlement 57.57 1/2, up 42 1/2. July pork bellies, I'm not sure what the story is here. No high is listed. The low in settlement, 61.30, down 120. August, 63.80. The high, 60.75. The low, the settlement, 61.30, down 120. The Dow is up 13 points at 83.45. The NASDAQ is up 5 at 17.98. And the S&P 500 is up 3 at 9.04. Nearby crude in New York down 17 cents at 59.47. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana. We're online at will.illinois.com. WVUW.edu. This is the Afternoon Magazine. The producer for the program, Harriet Williamson. My name is Celeste Quinn. Dan Pounder's forecast for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon. In northwestern Illinois, mostly cloudy with occasional showers and thunderstorms. In west, central, and northeastern Illinois, increasing cloudiness with showers and thunderstorms arriving. Elsewhere, partly to mostly sunny, highs ranging from 76 near Lake Michigan to around 90.